Hi, everyone. I'm Lindsay Moon. I am a part of WLS Newsroom. I produce Focus, our hour-long call-in talk show. And like Lisa said before the film, I'm from a small town. I graduated from high school that was five towns consolidated. And from those five towns, there were still only 40 people. So I've been chomping at the bit to discuss this film. So we're going to keep it kind of informal. I'd like to let our panelists introduce themselves for the evening. So and then we'll get their thoughts on the film. I first want to ask, how many people in here are from a small town, less than 10,000 people? Did any of you guys play sports in high school? Yeah? Okay. I want to hear from you later about what you thought about this film then. So, Bob, do you want to start?
I'm Bob Hughes. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Human and Community Development.
And I'm Mary Maurer. I'm the Assistant Dean for Field Education at the School of Social Work and a former school social worker.
My name is Carol Wilson-Smith. I'm also in the School of Social Work as a clinical assistant professor, and I'm also a former school social worker.
Great. Okay, so we're going to open it up for questions here in a minute, but quickly, since you guys all have experience in schools like this, do you want to briefly maybe summarize your thoughts after the film and some of the things that you thought the film demonstrated that are really relevant for small towns like Medora?
Well, I think that this is a story that's not just about communities and poverty and schools and school consolidation. I think this is also a story about families. And I think one of the things that sort of gets missed in all of this is how powerful and important adults are in this community and what a big difference they're making in the lives of these young people. And that sometimes it's just easy to focus on the sort of sadness and the sort of challenges of these folks. But I'm really proud of watching the adults in this movie as well.
I would totally agree with that. And I think it's also about tradition and, you know, just kind of the traditions that people want to hang on to and that really become a fabric of who they are and not wanting to lose that. And again, along with all the sadness, I think that there are a lot of strengths in this community.
Along with that, I also see the role of school and sports within the community and how it holds a community together, as well as the individual experiences of each of these boys and their families.
Great. After watching the film, if there's anyone here, I would be really curious to hear what you guys thought about the film. Mary Baranow, up there with the microphone, she has a microphone. So if you guys have questions or if there was something coming away from the film, if there was something that really tugged at you, we are interested to hear about it so we can talk about it. I was a high school basketball player and was a player on a team that used to go try and score as many points as I could coming when we played teams like that. So I think it was interesting the way that it was handled, and I'm also curious to hear if you guys thought, what you thought about some of the adults that were in the film. As Bob mentioned, some of them were really great role models for some of those kids. Anybody? Okay. You mentioned specifically, Bob, when we were talking yesterday, that we spent a little bit of time talking about the attachment that the town has to the school. And we talked a little bit about whether or not it is a responsible decision for some of those adults to be fighting so hard to keep the school in their town. Would you talk about that?
I don't recall saying anything about that in particular. I guess the thing that I worry about in these communities is that we only have sort of one solution to school consolidation, which is we bunch them all together in one building. And I do think that oftentimes that runs the risk of a town like Medora disappearing, just as some of those people described it. I'm guessing that the only real employer left in that community is that school. So if that big employer disappears, you know, there's even less reason to be in that community. So I think we got to figure out how to put small towns together and still keep the small towns and still keep more of the schools. You guys have spent more time thinking about schools.
Yeah, how to keep their identity. You know, there were so many people in the film that talked about how, I remember there was one woman who was working behind one of the counters in the store, and they said, how would you describe Medora? And she said, closed. And that was all she had to say. You know, Bob makes a great point that the main employer in the town may very well be the school. You know, they did speak of the plastics factory, but without the school, what is the town? You know, it was such a center point. There was another person who made the point of, if the school closes, this town is gone. It's over.
Well, and I think, too, that you can see kind of that weight on the boys' shoulders when they're when they continue to lose and they feel like they're letting down their community, their school, their parents, their families. And really, it's kind of the message that I get from that is that, as Carol's saying, is the school is really the center of what is keeping that community together. And I think that there's a lot of weight on the boys through the basketball of feeling like when they lose, they fail everybody, and what does that mean for their future, too? So,
Rusty in particular was one of the players that was struggling with some very adult issues, especially with his mother recovering from rehab and being an alcoholic. Do you think that the film did a good job of accurately portraying some of the struggles that high school students are going to face if they've got parents in situations like that?
I think they did a good job of portraying kids in high school in general, as far as the struggles they have, regardless if they have a parent who's struggling with alcoholism themselves. I think it's a time in most kids' lives where they're faced with challenges as far as making good choices. And, unfortunately for these kids in Medora, there's not much for them to do. And that is a real challenge for kids in rural communities in general. There's not places for them to go, things for them to do, and they often will end up getting into trouble for lack of things like that. And so communities who have really put together community centers for kids or different activities for them to become involved in, I think show some positive options for them versus kids who are just hanging out and they end up drinking or doing other things because there's not a lot for them to do.
Yeah, I think that young man Chaz, who gets kicked off the basketball team, I mean, in the final sort of credits, they say that, you know, he drops out after sophomore year, and you really do see that that maybe school and basketball and doing those kinds of things really kept a lot of those other kids in school, and maybe they would have dropped out too. Maybe Rusty would have never gone back had
Absolutely.
It not been for the basketball.
Sorry. Go ahead. No. Chaz even said earlier in the film that basketball was what he felt kept him out of trouble.
Right.
And so often we do see schools dealing with kids who get into trouble by pushing them out and excluding them from those activities, and basketball really is an example of something that can hold them together and help them to be successful. And working with those adults, you know, those mentors who are positive role models.
If you guys were the coach, would you have kicked him off the team?
Boy, that's a tough one, because I'm sure there are school policies and rules that you have to work within, but I sure would have kept him as connected as possible. So even if the rule was to keep him kicked off, I probably would have found a way to keep him connected in some way. And he was still in the stands, I noticed.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is something sometimes, that policies and procedures are put in place with good intentions, but sometimes they have these unintended consequences that often do affect kids like Chaz, where those really are the kids who don't have a lot going on as far as support systems and families and connectedness to other things. And that was probably his one kind of bright spot in his life, and now that's gone.
You mentioned policies and rules sometimes putting constraints around certain things that could really help people. I'm particularly interested to find out what your guys' take was on the part where Rusty was living with his friend and the mother was going to be evicted if she let him continue to live there because of the rules. Can you address that?
We talked about this yesterday when we were talking about the movie, that she lived in probably Section 8 housing where they have a voucher, and there's certain requirements that go along with that. And I'm sure that, when that was put into place and those requirements were put into place, there was probably with good intentions. But here it's a situation where this lovely woman is trying to provide a home for this boy who is homeless otherwise, since his mom is in rehab. And it ends up putting him back out on the street because otherwise her whole family is going to be out on the street. So it's, you know, you could tell that that was a really heart-wrenching thing for her to have to do because she certainly cares about this boy. But again, another situation of an unintended consequence that puts a 16-year-old out on the street.
With the rules for Section 8 housing, why would she have had to kick him out? That was one point that I didn't quite understand.
I don't know the specific rules. I'm guessing that she probably is allowed to have her family there, and he's not considered a part of the family. There may be limits as far as how many people can live in that home.
Yeah, that's one of the requirements of Section 8 housing is that you... there's a certain number of people that can be in the home depending on the size of the home, and you're allowed to have guests, but they have a certain amount of time that you can have guests, and after that time you can be evicted if you violate that rule.
But I'm still struck by just how, I mean, how caring she was.
Absolutely.
In terms of looking after mm-hmm. him. And she too was in the stands, you know, watching and cheering on
right.
those
yeah.
kids
right.
too.
Absolutely.
So, yes.
My name is Charles Ross. I taught high school social studies in Shelbyville and then in Monticello and then went to the faculty and staff at the history department, ISU, working with schools all across this area. First of all, you know, we live, change is the name of the game. I mean, we all face situations where we have to change things. My personal opinion is, because in both in Shelbyville and Monticello, we saw schools having to be closed. Now, they were a part of our unit district, but this whole argument about you'll destroy our community, Medora is done. I mean, there is, in the schools, others that I've been in, we have an unusual situation in Piatt County in that DeLand Weldon is somehow maintaining very strong, you know, community support appears to be the reason. But they're very much in this situation. The Monticello schools are now extending out the invitation to the other schools in the county. Let's talk about, you know, what our future is going to be and is there anything to come that would be helpful in consolidation. Now, they were right in the part about if they get consolidated, the kids are going to go into a larger school. You still have only 5 kids playing on the basketball team at one time, and that means that some of those kids from Medora are not going to play. I certainly would not have been able to play 4 years of high school baseball if I'd gone to Carbondale Community rather than Carbondale University School. And so there was that advantage by being small. But, you know, my earlier point, change is taking place. Unless somehow the government is able to encourage new startup businesses or to encourage businesses that already exist who want to open up another factory or another place, you know, then that may be a way to save some of those small towns. But there's a point at which you just simply have to say, you know, we can't afford $284,000 in debt. It's just absolutely tough.
Well, I think we would totally agree with that. I think that kind of the challenges with this is we can see both sides to it, you know, that the struggle of the families not wanting to let go of what their history has been, but the other side of it of what's best for the kids as far as their education, opportunities. These kids are not going to be competitive with other kids as far as college opportunities and things because they don't have the classes available to them that other kids do as well. So it's certainly, I think that there's definitely on both sides reasons why you really need to look at both sides. But, you know, as a school social worker, you know, we're about helping kids to be successful in school, and it's really hard to see these kids knowing that they just are not receiving the education that other kids are.
And I think there's like a real question about whether or not we want small towns or not. I mean, and I think that's a bigger decision than just Medora's decision. I think that's all of our decision. And you do sort of wonder if the best place for everybody to live is in large, giant places, if there isn't some advantage to having a society in which there are different size communities. And I don't know what that right mix is, and certainly we've watched all of these small towns, lots and lots of them, disappear over the last 50 years. But I still wonder, you know, is there something there worth saving? I see somebody else with a microphone.
Hi, Jeff Bossert. I work with Lindsay at the WILL. This thing really hit home for me because I'm from a town of 600 people, and I did my school did consolidate before my senior year, and so many went to one school and so many went to the other, and there are still people today that say that that's not my school, the school they, you know, in my class who spent their senior year at that school. And and the school where I went, only the gym remains now. It was torn down. And that was the thing to do, just like the kids in Medora, on Friday night street parties, or, you know, go out and drink beer. So I would say for me that the consolidation was good, as kind of brought up here, is that I was not an athlete, and I got to play in band and sing in a real choir and had no idea what it really sounded like until I was a senior in high school. So, but I definitely can see the argument of old friends today that, you know, gosh, we want to have a reunion just for our, just for our classmates, not these other kids that we had to go to school with for 1 year.
Yeah, it's that small town culture. You know, there are some people that feel very strongly about their attachment to their small town and where they come from, and it's hard to let that go.
And there's lots of good things about that attachment. Yeah. I mean, there's, it's good that they're attached.
I'm from an extremely small town, essentially a town of one. The closest store was 30 miles away, so I had to go to boarding school. So I have a feel for some of this, and I also look at it from still having lived here for 50 years, I still look at things as an outsider sometimes. The way I see it is that the Western democracies are going to have to isolate themselves and say that we cannot deal with labor that costs a dollar a day. Because no matter what you do, the guy who's making a buck a day and can buy all the automated machinery you want is going to whip you. So we have to decide that we're going to isolate ourselves. We will not deal with cheap labor. We will let people in cheap labor communities deal with cheap labor. Then we can support. The idea that we'll go to a $15 minimum wage just means nobody's going to have a job. On the other hand, if you don't pay them $15 an hour, they can't make a living. And they have to have work. The work is going to China, is going to India. After that, it's going to go to Africa. This can go to South America. It's not going to come back here if we maintain the model that we have right now. Right now, nobody is thinking about this model. How are we going to change it? How are we going to give advantages to the small communities? I was in the engineering business for a while. I was self-employed most of my life. And I called on all the small towns and every factory about halfway to Chicago, halfway to St. Louis, halfway to Indianapolis. And there were a lot of little companies. For an example, in there's a town. Where's that kettle? The kettle restaurant that we went to? Near Farmer City, there's a little town. Anyways, there's a little town, and they had a little factory that employed about 20 people. And they made little coils, little magnetic coils, a little piece of wire wrapped around a piece of iron. And that factory had been there for years and years and years. All of a sudden, it's gone. Where are all those coils coming from? Well, some of those coils have been eliminated by technology. Technology eats jobs. We have to get that into our heads. Technology, automation, the good life eats jobs. We would prefer everything to be made automatically, everything to be not deal with labor. The whole idea, I used to be president of Rhino Robots in town here. The whole idea of robotics is to eliminate labor, get rid of labor. there's all kinds of talk. Well, you know, the things work better and things are smarter and it's a better life. But the bottom line is, man, get rid of labor. That's what it's all about. So unless we artificially decide that we're going to create jobs, for example, instead of paying people for unemployment, we should pay people to take Medora apart, clean it up, and rebuild it. That's what needs to be done so that it's viable. The way it is right now, it's a junk pile. Nobody wants to go to Medora. The people who want to live in Medora have other reasons for living it, not because it's a great lifestyle, not because it's a garden community. It's a mess. So that needs to be fixed. I traveled as a part of my job at Rhino Robots. I traveled all over the world, and I go over to people on the West Coast, and they say, well, you know, we need jobs, and all these lumberjacks don't have jobs. I say, okay, what do you want to do? So, well, we've got all these forests. We need to cut them down and create jobs for these people. I said, well, okay, fine. Next year, the forests are going to be gone. Then what are you going to do? Okay? The sensible thing to do is to pay these people to plant forests. We've got forests in southern Illinois that was planted in FDR's time. That can be done. I don't see that anywhere in the United States. I've seen it in Canada. You can see these forests are 5 years old. These forests are 15 years old. These forests are getting ready to be harvested. I have never seen that in the United States. And I've traveled fairly extensively. So we need to really change. If we want to preserve the small towns, and, you know, I'm a real fan of small towns. If you want to preserve them, we need a shift in how we think about these things. None of the politicians is thinking about it. They don't have a clue about it. And I don't see a change, and it's very, very sad to me. But that's the way it is.
I'm curious that you bring up the idea of preserving small towns or figuring out a way. If you could bring the brick factory, for example, back to Medora, could you rebuild the town? Or is the lifestyle that some of those people enjoy in the past? What do you guys think?
There's a certain, you know, if you have 100 people or 1,000 people in a town, you can say that if everybody works 2,000 hours a year and there's 1,000 people, there's 2 million hours of work available in that community. Or the ability to do 2,000 hours of work is, or 2 million hours of work is within that community. So the question becomes, how do we use our good senses to do something with those 2 million hours instead of riding around or sitting in a bar or doing whatever you want to do? You know, there's some, that's not part of the 2,000 hours. That's leisure time. The 2,000 hours is the work time, okay? And there doesn't seem to be a vehicle or thinking or anything about, you know, how do we preserve this? Some of our best people come from small towns because it's a different type of an environment. The other side of the coin is that the big cities haven't worked. I've been to New York. We go through 50 miles of slums, and you talk to your city, your rep, hey, listen, can we stop and take a leak? Oh, no, we can't stop here. We got to get to the other side of this. We'll get killed if we stop somewhere over here, you know. And nobody is willing to say it. The big cities have not worked. In Chicago, there's the Magnificent Mile. Three blocks away is a mess. You know, we don't want to look at that. So unless we open our eyes and look at this thing, 2020, hard 2020, we can't fix it. We're unwilling to look at it right now.
I'd like to throw it back to our panelists. In the towns that you guys have been in and from your experience, I'm interested, if some of those schools were to consolidate, is that a way towards rebuilding, to keep some of those towns alive, maybe just in sort of a different format?
I think that depends. I think that depends on the identity of the towns and whether, how connected they feel to their school, like how much part the school plays in their identity. So there are a couple of schools near the Springfield area that consolidated a few years ago, and they'd been rivals for years and years, and so the consolidation has been very difficult for them, and I'd say that one town has probably kind of dominated and has become more of the identity than the other one. So I think it depends. It's town to town and the people who are there.
Well, and I think we forget about the fact that Champaign-Urbana, I mean, I'm an immigrant to this community, so when we arrived here and discovered that in a place where there was less than 100,000 people, that you had two school systems and twice as much administrative work as you could, you know, possibly create. And for those people who have lived in these communities, when I say that out loud, I mean, they sort of say, we wouldn't dare, you know, cross those boundaries and consolidate Champaign and Urbana. But we have duplicate government systems all over Champaign County, whether it's, you know, township areas and so forth. At one point in the neighborhood I lived in, we actually were claimed by both the township and the city, and so we got to pay twice as many taxes until they sort of worked that out. But, you know, these odd boundaries we've created, these odd government systems, I mean, we haven't really thought through, you know, are there better, easier ways to do these? But part of it is we're really attached to those. And I think we know, if put to a vote, that, you know, I'm sure 80% of the residents of both Champaign and Urbana would refuse to either become one city or to become one school district. I'm confident of that. I mean, in fact, whenever it's even described, you know, it gets shot down, you know, within a first week of even discussing it in this community. So these are hard things, and people, what may seem like a simple practical solution to an outsider like me is seen as, you know, violating a lot of tradition and a lot of attachment to things in this community. So, I knew I would get reaction.
Was anybody else struck by the economic level of what was going on in this movie? The kid had a car. Where did that money come from? He had a cell phone. And they all, on the bus, they all had iPods, and, you know, this was supposed to be economically distressed area. I was also amused at the family that had, like, six dogs in their household. What they were choosing to spend their money on seemed odd to me. I mean, that's not my choice to make, obviously, but... the store, I mean, you know, the town looked absolutely desperate. And the kids all had name brand clothes on.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Some of that, from my experience, is kind of a culture of poverty that families often will spend their money on what we might see as unwise choices when they need to pay the rent and put food on the table. But I have gone to many home visits where they have got a better TV than I do, but they're struggling to pay their bills. And it's hard not to judge that, very honestly, sometimes. But I think that my experience is that they tend to live, when you live in poverty, you tend to live in the moment, and you want to provide for your kids sometimes, you know, the best pair of shoes because you think that that's being a good parent, or you don't want them to look different than the other kids at the school, or you feel like the gadgets that you have somehow provide a little bit of, I don't know what the word is, but you...
Status,
thank you. And so there are choices that are made sometimes that you do just kind of scratch your head at, but it does tend to be kind of a cultural thing of families in poverty.
I've had the same experience. I've been to plenty of home visits where they have lovely leather furniture throughout the whole house, and then 6 weeks later go back and it's gone because they aren't able to afford it. But it is a matter of status. It's a matter of feeling like they are equal to others.
I also, coming from a small high school and having a lot of families that were like that in my district, there were quite a few girls that I went to high school with that would have Hollister shirts and stuff. They bought them at Goodwill. There's a lot of name brand clothes like that that you can find at thrift stores. So, you know, it is possible that they weren't spending a whole lot of money on clothing, right, and that was just a product of, you know, the places they were able to go to purchase clothing.
Right. And, you know, when Carol talks about the leather couches, a lot of families who live in poverty do, like, you know, the rent-to-own things. They don't necessarily go out and purchase a $3,000 couch, but they do some of the rent-to-own. They do some things that maybe, again, we would say... financially, that's not a good decision, but it's, you know, kind of these piecemeal things that they can pay for when they can, and then the leather couch is gone because they can't keep up with the payments. So,
do you have another question or comment?
Yeah, I was just curious, in your work as school social workers, resources or supports that you had seen that worked, and some of the things that people could get involved with, perhaps to help schools, you know, some of the positives.
There are a lot of community agencies that become very involved with the schools, and school social workers in their buildings will get to know the families very well, especially the families that have a lot of needs, and they also get to know the community as well as the agencies in there. So anytime that other people can get involved in community agencies and play a role in that and provide, whether it be donations, mentoring to students, mentoring to parents as well, there are all sorts of opportunities in our community.
And I think that's one of the challenges that we see in Medora, but not just Medora, in many rural communities, is access to services. You know, even in Rantoul, it's very hard for families to get to Champaign sometimes to get the mental health services for their kids, and there's really not a lot available in Rantoul for them. So it's not just a Medora type of situation. It's typically rural communities have a difficult time accessing some of the things that a Champaign-Urbana community might have.
The town I grew up in had under 100 people. And when my mother was starting school, my grandfather took an acre of our farm and built a school. I don't know how the logistics of that all worked, but that's what he did. And the kids that went to that school came from our little town and from another equally little town that was a mile away. And I was in the biggest class ever to go through the school, and there were six in my class. And when I was ready to go into seventh grade, it was a K through eight school. When I was ready to go into seventh grade, the school board in the big town, the even bigger town than our little ones, they decided to close our junior high. There was a court case over the whole thing, and some people in my town basically never spoke again that I knew of. And then about the time I graduated from high school, which would have been six more years, they closed the whole school. And that was the end of the town, pretty much. And the school is now a meth lab. And our farmhouse wasn't maybe a quarter of a mile from the school. And my father lived in the farmhouse for a long period of time when he was legally blind. And I was always worried because basically the town, all of the nice families that were there when I was growing up were all gone. And the families that had the extended family that inherited the houses, it was cheap rent. Real cheap rent it became. And I used to worry about my father because, you know, everybody knew that he was blind, and it has become a very rough place. But everybody's life changed when the school was closed. I think that had to happen. And by the way, my high school class had 36 kids, and it was a merger of four towns. But the life in my little town was never the same, but I think it was inevitable that probably happened. But it was a very bad time because of the ill feelings toward the bigger town where the school board was, and then because of the people in my town that were pro and con the whole situation.
Yeah, I think the other thing that we can need to include in all of this is the fact that another big change in our communities has been that all the farms are much bigger than they once were. And so in the past, there were lots and lots of families who lived on farms, and there would be towns that they served, and that's where you went to church, and that's where you got came together and all of those kinds of things. I mean, again, back to sort of this mechanization idea that was brought up earlier. I mean, that's change dramatically the size of farms in these communities. So you've also lost an awful lot of those folks from these communities as well, and they were certainly an integral part of what made the small towns work. And again, that's not going to come back. I mean, we're not going to have, suddenly, 100-acre farms anymore, even though, 100 acres is, big compared to what they were at the turn of the 20th century. But again, these changes do sort of keep going. I think the idea that earlier of that were the ideas that were suggested in terms of rethinking sort of economics and those parts of things are really important ideas. And one of the things that I spent some time looking at recently, I just sort of was working on something else and sort of went back and sort of read about the labor movement at the beginning of the 20th century. And the statistic that really stuck out to me during that period of time, the height of the time in which there was child labor in this country was 1920. And one out of every five young people under 16 was working either in a factory or working in actually sort of big sort of labor farms on farms. And we decided that was a bad idea. And now we wouldn't think about one in five of our kids out working in those kinds of conditions. And we decided to change that. And we invented, and people said then, if you took all the kids out of those factories, we couldn't make them work. We couldn't, the world wouldn't work. Well, obviously we did it, and we're much better off for it. So we did change it. And so it struck me that things can look pretty bad. That was really bad. But we decided collectively that's not how we wanted to live. That's not how we wanted our children to live. So there was a group of mostly women who went around and started lobbying against that and basically brought those factory owners to bear and made that public, showed all the injuries that those kids were suffering. And we changed it. So those kinds of things, helping remember a bit of our history, I think ought to give us hope that things that may not look good now, that we can probably do something about that, and that there's probably a set of ideas where we can make Medora work, and maybe it is literally planting forests and growing small plots of vegetables or other kinds of things. I don't know what the answer to those is, but I think we need all those ideas and we need to try them out, and we all need to be working on them.
I think one of the things that you need to think about is that the ability to work, you have to have a right to work. You have to have the idea that everybody has to have a right to work, which, because that makes you a part of the community. The overriding thing on this is that there's only so much work to be done because we're automating everything. This means everybody is going to have to work less. That means we need to think about reducing the 40-hour week. And in some ways, that's already happening. People are working 9 to 4:30 in the big towns that is moving in that direction. But it needs to move in a much, much larger way in that direction. And I don't see any great economic thinkers talking in that direction or big articles in the Wall Street Journal that say, or the New York Times that say, listen, we really need a 30-hour week because there's a lot of people running around with nothing to do, and we need to share this idea. On the other side, we have the stories about how the gauchos in Argentina now have cell phones and how wonderful it is. Well, it is wonderful, but what has happened is all the labor that went into stretching all the wires that we stretched in the United States and all the little coils that we wound and all the little rivets that we made, we robbed Argentina of all that. They will no longer need to go through all of that. So we need to think about how we do these things when we give technology to people that aren't quite ready for it. things get out of control.
I'm interested, we talked a little bit in the meeting before the screening of the movie. You mentioned that you're from a much larger community and learned a lot about rural America moving to Champaign-Urbana. And I'm interested, if you're going to have a movement of people that wants to try and rebuild small-town America, you're going to have to educate a large portion of the population that grew up in urban centers. Lots of the population is focused in places like New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, for example. Do you think that it's possible, and how do you think, as a society, we might be able to bridge that urban-rural divide as it's been coined by the media, I guess?
It's so funny you said that, because I watched the movie with my 11-year-old daughter, and her idea was just, you invite all your friends to just come live next door to you, and you rebuild the town that way. So there really is the importance to educate people about what small towns have to offer and what they have provided in the past and what has been so good about them and what we still can benefit from by having those small towns.
I think that's a really good question. And
what's that?
It might be kind of a hard sell.
It's absolutely a hard sell. That's what, you know, as we were talking about it in my house when we watched the film. It is a hard sell, you know. When you compare a city to, you can walk down the street and get what you need in a small town, you know, you really do have to work to get to your resources, and you really do have to connect with your neighbors and get to know them. But there are absolutely benefits to connecting to your neighbors and getting to know them and feeling a part of your community.
Well, and I think, too, that, you know, you said that the term was coined by the media. I think that the media sometimes portrays small towns kind of like what we saw in Medora, too. I mean, it isn't necessarily that you see the strengths of the small towns. It's more that you see, like, what you don't get in a small town. You know, when we were even talking yesterday about internet access, whether or not the kids in this town, I mean, the one kid was on a laptop, but, you know, I can tell you, my kids would go crazy because the speed is probably not as fast as what they're used to, and it might drive me a little crazy, too. So I think that we become a kind of, I don't know.
Spoiled,
yeah, that's a good word. We become very spoiled with what we have right at our fingertips. My brother lives in a very small town that doesn't have a grocery store. It has a gas station, and that's it. And I go there, and I'm sitting there, and we did not grow up there, so it's not a town that I have any emotional connection to. He moved there after he got married and had a family. And he is a small town person. He loves living in a small town. He loves knowing all of his neighbors. I go there, and I am ready to leave in an hour because it's just a very different environment than what I'm used to. But I respect the fact that there's many people that live there that have lived there all their lives. It's probably got 500 people in the town. And I think when you come from a different background, you know, it's hard to see sometimes the positives of the other, but I think that coming together and having the conversation is a starting point.
I think one of the important points is that in these small towns, there have to be some folks who've got the skills and for example, we spent last fall in Lanesboro, Minnesota. Heard of Lanesboro?
No, what's the population?
700 people, 39 bed and breakfasts, and it has a $2.5 million community theater building. And it has recreational bike paths and so on. And this man and his family invested their money in this theater thing, and it is now, you know, you haven't been anywhere in terms of community theater unless you've gone to Lanesburg. And so it seems to me, I mean, I didn't see anybody in this film that suggested that they had the wherewithal to be able to organize, or that, you know, this particular man and his family had lots of money. And they invested in the community, and the community came back from almost falling apart. It's in a beautiful setting.
Well, it's like 40 miles from Rochester.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's a bedroom community for Mayo and so on. But I think that, you know, if there's not some key person or persons, it's not going to happen.
Well, and I think we were talking, too, about how Medora actually isn't that far from, was it Louisville?
Yeah.
So it's got, I mean, it's like 40 miles, I think, from Louisville. So there are, I mean, kind of a similar situation where it could be a bedroom community where people live there, went to work, came home. And there's a lot of small towns like that. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right that maybe there's kind of a lack of vision for the town, too. People are saying, well, this is what it used to be, but not really looking forward to seeing how it could still thrive.
Well, the coach was a policeman for Bedford, which is about 25 or 30 miles to the west of this town.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you see in your work, I guess, in some of the small towns in this area, that there might be that vision moving forward for some communities in East Central Illinois? Okay. Well, it's 9:15, and I feel like it's getting a little bit late to keep everyone here. So, does anyone have any last thoughts moving forward about the film or anything? Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. I think it's been a really wonderful discussion, and I hope you enjoyed the film. I learned a lot from it, mm-hmm. and I'm interested in learning more about basketball in Indiana now too. So, Hoosiers. Yes, I need to watch that. Okay. Well, if we'd have an applause for our panelists and for you guys too for participating, thanks for coming tonight. So, as Lisa said, the next community cinema event is Tuesday, June 3rd. So, come back here at 7.